The Earnings and Pensions Act deals with income from employment, as well as other income, such as that from pensions and from certain social security benefits. An employment, in this context, includes any employment under a contract of service, as well as apprenticeships and services for the Crown. Employments also cover office holders, such as directors. The Act simply refers to all employees and directors as employees. Employment income generally falls under two main categories. These are general earnings and specific employment income. General earnings are the most prevalent and consist of remuneration paid in normal monetary form, i.e. cash, as well as certain non-monetary rewards, such as taxable benefits. The definition of general earnings also extends to certain other payments, such as sick or liability pay, certain payments to pension schemes, and payments for restrictive covenants. In essence, general earnings covers payments made to the employee as a reward for services rendered. Specific employment income broadly covers certain payments made to the employee by his employer which are not part of the usual remuneration package, and is defined by the Earnings and Pensions Act as any amount which counts as employment income, excluding any exempt income. We shall deal with exempt income later. Income which counts as employment income is divided into three, being 1. Income which is not earnings or share-related, 2. Share-related income, or 3. Any other enactment, i.e. employment income which is taxable but which doesn't fit any of the other categories. Non-share-related income broadly encompasses termination payments and employer contributions to unapproved pension schemes. Share-related income covers profits and gains made by employees from various share option and share incentive schemes offered by the employer. We will deal with each of these in future modules. Earnings are defined within Section 62 of ITEPA 2003. Earnings cover any salary, wages or fee, any gratuity or other profit or incidental benefit obtained by the employee, if it is money or money's worth, anything else that constitutes an emolument of the employment. Broadly speaking, earnings are cash remuneration or any form of payment of direct monetary value which can be converted into cash. This will cover obvious forms of payment, such as salaries and bonuses, but will also cover tips and gratuities received in the course of carrying out one's employment duties, or payments in the form of cash vouchers or premium bonds, which can be surrendered for cash. This is what we mean by the term money or money's worth. The definition of earnings does not extend to benefits in kind, e.g. company cars, low-interest loans, living accommodation, etc., as such remuneration is neither cash nor of direct monetary value. However, the provision of such benefits is catered for under the Benefits Code, which we shall look at in detail in later modules. There is a significant body of case law to determine the existence of an emolument of an employment. This term was part of the old statutory provisions and was specifically retained in ITEPA 2003 to ensure that the case law was still applicable. Emoluments of an employment are chargeable to tax under Section 62. The key words here are of the employment. Just because a payment is made by an employer to an employee, it does not automatically follow that the payment is from the employment. For a payment to be treated as being from an employment, the payment must generally be made in return for services, either past, present, or future. Let us consider the case of Hamlet and Godfrey from 1987. In this case, an employee of a government agency was offered £1,000 as compensation for agreeing to give up her rights to join a trade union. The employee contended that the payment was not an emolument from her employment, as it was not being made in return for services. In this case, the courts disagreed and found the payment to be a taxable emolument. The right to join a trade union is part and parcel of acting or being an employee. The payment was too closely linked to the employer-employee relationship for it to be treated as anything other than an emolument. In Shilton and Wilmshurst from 1991, a footballer, England goalkeeper Peter Shilton, transferred from Nottingham Forest to Southampton Football Club. As the player was under contract to Nottingham Forest, the club agreed to pay Mr. Shilton £75,000 to agree to the transfer. Again, the question arose as to whether this payment arose from the employment. Mr. Shilton contended that the payment was made to him by his former employer in connection with the termination of his employment. As we shall see later, such termination payments are tax-free up to £30,000. The Revenue argued that the payment was a reward or inducement flowing from the services he was about to offer to Southampton FC. The courts agreed with the Revenue and found the payment to have arisen from Mr. Shilton's employment. The payment was, therefore, fully taxable. Mr. Shilton had received payment to remain or become an employee. The payment was to induce the player to become an employee of Southampton FC, and for no other reason. Section 9, ITEPA 2003, deals with how much of a taxpayer's income is chargeable to income tax for a particular tax year. In the case of general earnings, i.e. cash earnings plus benefits in kind, the amount charged to tax is the net taxable earnings from the employment in the tax year. To arrive at net taxable earnings, we start with cash remuneration, such as salaries and bonuses, etc. To this, we add non-cash remuneration, such as benefits in kind. This gives taxable earnings for the tax year. Net taxable earnings are taxable earnings less any deductions allowed from those earnings under the expenses provisions within the Act. Essentially, employees receive tax relief in respect of any expenses wholly, exclusively, and necessarily incurred in doing their job. Certain other expenses, for example, professional subscriptions and donations to charity, may also be deducted at this point to arrive at net taxable earnings. We shall look specifically at employment expenses in a later module. It is this figure of net taxable earnings that goes into the tax computation as non-savings income. Section 15, ITEPA 2003, deals with general earnings of an employee, resident, ordinarily resident and domiciled in the UK, and tells us that the full amount of any earnings which are received in a tax year is an amount of taxable earnings from the employment in that tax year. Therefore, the way we tax an individual's employment income is on a receipts basis. This means that employees and directors will be taxed on their employment income when it is received. The rules for taxing earnings are slightly different for employees who are either resident, ordinarily resident, or domiciled outside the UK, and these will be covered in a later session. The date of receipt for employment income purposes is the earlier of two dates. First, we identify the date of entitlement. Then we consider the date that the emolument is physically received by the employee. So if an employee or director becomes entitled to a payment before he or she is physically paid the money, the date of entitlement is treated as the date of receipt, and the payment is taxed at that point. In practice, this distinction is not particularly important, as for most of us, the date of entitlement and the date of physical receipt are usually the same. Where the receipts basis becomes important is with regard to the taxation of bonuses. Consider a company which draws up accounts for the year ended the 31st of December 2009. On the 28th of April 2010, the annual general meeting is held and the board of directors of the company sign off the accounts and agree the profits of the year just ended. At this point, the company are in a position to determine the bonuses due to their employees. An employee receives a bonus at the end of April 2010 in respect of work carried out by him in the year, which ended in December 2009. For employment income purposes, the employee is taxed on his bonus not in the period in which the bonus was earned, but instead on the date the bonus is physically received. This is the receipts basis. As such, this bonus is taxable at the end of April 2010 and therefore goes into the employee's tax computation for 2010-11. This is a general principle, and there are always occasional exceptions. For directors, certain special rules exist, but in most cases, the normal receipts basis will apply. In relation to company directors, the date of receipt is the earlier of the date of entitlement or the date of physical receipt, or of either of the following three dates. A. When sums on account of his earnings are credited in the company accounts, or B. At the end of the company's accounting period, if the earnings have been determined by the end of that period, or C. At the date the earnings are determined, if that date falls after the end of the company's accounting period. We shall illustrate this with an example. Mr. Matthews is a company director. He is entitled to an annual bonus based on the company's results for each year ending on the 31st of December. At their board meeting on the 25th of March 2011, the board agree the draft accounts and determine Mr. Matthews' bonus in the sum of £25,000. This is paid to Mr. Matthews on the 30th of April 2011. Although the date of physical receipt is the 30th of April 2011, as Mr. Matthews is a director, we need to consider the special rules in Section 18 ITEPA 2003. Mr. Matthews' earnings were determined after the end of the company's accounting period. Therefore, Rule C above applies. The date of receipt for employment income purposes is therefore the 25th of March 2011, and the bonus will be taxable in 2010-11. Benefits are very important both in a practical context and for those studying this course for examination purposes. By benefits, we mean non-cash remuneration. Many employees currently receive payments in kind as part of their overall remuneration package. These payments in kind often include the use of a company car, the use of company-provided accommodation or an interest-free or low-interest loan, private medical insurance or contributions by the employer to the employee's pension scheme are also very common benefits, as is the provision of a mobile phone, along with associated telephone calls. The majority of these benefits are taxable in the hands of the employee. There are certain tax-free benefits, and we shall deal with these later. For benefits that are chargeable to tax, we need to determine the cash equivalent of each particular benefit. Essentially, we are allocating a cash figure to each taxable benefit, and thereafter we will tax that cash equivalent as if it was an additional amount of earnings. Having found the cash equivalent of the benefit, we add this to the salaries and bonuses, etc., to arrive at the employment income figure. That figure then goes into the income tax computation in the non-savings income column. Benefits are chargeable to tax if they are either specifically charged within the benefits code, or they are employment-related benefits under Section 201 onwards of ITEPA 2003. We shall look at specific benefits within the benefits code in later sessions, but first we will examine the general rules for taxing employment-related benefits. An employment-related benefit is a benefit provided either for an employee or for a member of the employee's family or household by reason of the employee's employment. Therefore, a taxpayer cannot avoid being taxed on the provision of a benefit in kind simply by directing his employer to provide the benefit to, say, his wife rather than himself. This means, for example, if by reason of Jack's employment, Jack's wife or son are provided with a company car or other benefit, it is Jack who will be charged to income tax on the cash equivalent of that benefit. Section 203 ITEPA 2003 tells us that the cash equivalent of an employment-related benefit is the cost of the benefit, less any part of that cost made good by the employee to the persons providing that benefit. The cost of an employment-related benefit in this instance is the expense incurred by the employer in the provision of that benefit. This means that, for example, if an employer wishes to provide a benefit to an employee in the form of, say, private medical insurance, and the cost to the employer of paying the premium is £500, the cash equivalent, i.e. the amount charged to tax, is £500. The fact that it might cost the employee more than £500 to obtain the same level of medical cover is irrelevant. We simply look at what it costs the employer to provide the benefit. Any amounts paid by the employee to the employer as a part payment towards the provision of the benefit can be deducted from the cash equivalent. Therefore, if the employee reimburses the employer's full cost, the taxable benefit will be zero. Every taxable benefit provided by an employer to an employee which has a cash equivalent must be reported to the revenue by the employer on a special form called a P11D. The employer should complete a form P11D for each employee who has received taxable benefits, and these forms should be submitted to the revenue no later than 6th of July after the end of the tax year. The P11D tells the revenue the amount of the cash equivalent of each benefit. A copy is given to the employee to enable him to complete his own tax return. In the case of certain benefits, it is very difficult to establish exactly what is the cost to the employer of providing the benefit. In such cases, special rules exist to help us calculate the cash equivalent. Special rules are in place for calculating company car and fuel benefits, accommodation benefits, interest-free or low-interest loans, and instances where an employer lends an asset to an employee. We shall take a look at these various special rules later. The concept of the cost of providing a benefit was the subject of a leading and extremely important tax case heard by the House of Lords in 1993. The case of Pepper and Hart concerned a private fee-paying school. Just before the start of term, the school had some surplus places, which it had been unable to sell. The school therefore allowed some of the schoolmasters to send their own children to the school to be educated at a subsidised price. The Inland Revenue and the schoolmasters both agreed that a benefit in kind had arisen. This was because an employee or members of his family or household were being provided with a benefit, i.e. cheap education, by reason of the schoolmaster's employment. There was no dispute that a benefit in kind had arisen. The argument was about how to determine the cost to the employer in providing the education to the children involved. Each side put forward an alternative way of establishing the cost to the school of providing the benefit. The inspector argued that we should first take the total cost of running the school for the year. This figure should then be divided by the number of pupils in the school to give an average cost of providing education per student. From this average cost, we can deduct the fees actually paid by the schoolmasters, and the difference is the taxable benefit. The inspector therefore argued that cost of providing, as per the legislation, actually means the average cost. The taxpayer put forward an alternative suggestion. He argued that we first calculate the cost of running the school for its normal fee-paying pupils, i.e. not counting those students receiving subsidised education. Next, we calculate the cost of running the school for all the pupils, this time including the additional children who had paid reduced fees. The difference between these two figures is the additional cost incurred by the school in providing these extra places. Therefore, the cost of providing each additional place is this figure divided by the number of extra places. From this, we deduct the fees paid by the schoolmasters, and the difference is the taxable benefit. What the taxpayer was advocating was a marginal cost method, as opposed to the inspector's average cost method. The House of Lords, on a majority decision, found in favour of the taxpayer and decided that the marginal cost method was the correct way of calculating the cash equivalent in this instance. The case of Pepper and Hart has particular relevance when it comes to calculating the benefit in respect of in-house benefits, as we shall now illustrate.